Hello, and welcome back to Cambridge PhD Casts. And today I'm speaking to Andy Wimbush, who's a PhD student in the Faculty of English, and he's working on Samuel Beckett and quietism. So, Andy, if you'd like to start by introducing us to Samuel Beckett.
Yeah, sure. He's an Irish writer. Mm-hmm. Most people will know him as a playwright. He's the author of Waiting for Godot, Endgame, Crap's Last Tape. Mm-hmm. Generally thought of as quite a philosophical author, often put in the line of people like Joyce and Proust and then later influencing people like Harold Pinter. But he was also a writer of novels as well, and that's mainly where my research is focused.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. And would you like to maybe give us a bit of an introduction to what quietism means?
Okay, yeah, sure. So quietism actually is something from well before Beckett's lifetime. It's a kind of heretical form of Christian mysticism. Mm-hmm. So a mystic would be a kind of religious person who tries to experience God through intuition and insight, as opposed to maybe rational theology or more traditional practices. And quietism really takes this to its extreme. So in the 17th century, you've got a lot of mystics who are exploring the legacy of people like St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, very famous mystics. And they take what's called contemplative prayer to a real extreme. So they say that in contemplative prayer, you should just do nothing. You shouldn't be thinking about God. You shouldn't be praying out loud. Mm-hmm. You should just be sitting there doing nothing, being very passive mm-hmm. until your ego is annihilated into God.
Mm-hmm. So it's extreme passivity.
That's right. That's right. And an emphasis on unknowing as well. Impotence of the self. Mm-hmm. So God is doing everything.
Okay, so that's the kind of 17th century origins. And what can we say about what happened to quietism between its 17th century birth and Beckett's encounter with it?
So I think Beckett first encounters it in the philosophy of Arthur Schopenhauer, mm-hmm. so who's a German philosopher from the 19th century. Schopenhauer is an atheist, but he has a lot of respect for mystics and quietists and ascetics of lots of traditions. Mm-hmm. And he feels that quietism, this philosophy of the resignation of the self, the annihilation of the will, is the kind of common thread that runs through all religious mysticism. So you'd find it in Buddhism, you'd find it in Hinduism, you'd find it in Sufism, which is the Islamic mysticism. And he really admires people like Madame Guyon and Miguel de Molinos, who are the original Christian quietists. Mm-hmm. Beckett starts reading Schopenhauer in 1930. He's writing a little essay on Proust. This is before Beckett's famous, before he's written any of his creative writings. He's a young man, and he's writing this book on Proust. He knows that Proust was interested in Schopenhauer, so he starts reading Schopenhauer for himself. And it's this time he starts using the word quietism in lots of his letters.
Okay. Well, first of all, I mean, before we get onto what it is, maybe that grabbed him about it, do you want to tell us a bit more about how it appears, so where it shows up in his letters or in his own writings?
Sure. So Beckett connects it with lots of writers that he admires, so Marcel Proust, mm-hmm. Also the German novelist Thomas Mann. He mm-hmm. reads Mann's novel Buddenbrooks, and he says that a passage in this is a good basis for quietism. Mm-hmm. He also talks about it in connection with Dostoevsky, the Russian writer, and also the French novelist André Gide, who Beckett's a great admirer of. So he's using it in connection with these writers he really admires, which tells us something about how he's going to use it later on. Yeah. He's also using it to describe his own kind of lifestyle at this point. There's a great letter that he writes to his cousin, mm-hmm. Sonny. Beckett's living in London at this point. He's moved away from Dublin. And this is in 1934. And he's writing back home to his cousin, Sonny. And he's particularly concerned with a horse that belongs to Sonny. So Sonny has this horse outside of Dublin, and this is what Beckett says. "Delighted to hear that life is looking kindly on you, notwithstanding the rather green climate of your humanities, and that strange quadruped with the inverted humps is keeping up his serenity. That animal has always inspired in me a certain anxiety, which is that the very quietistic life he leads might drive him one of these days to throw himself, like the biblical swine, into the sea." So I think that's kind of revealing, not so much about what it says about the horse, but really about what it says about Beckett himself, which is that quietism is both a kind of mode of serenity, but also something that might lead to despair and suicide. Mm-hmm. And this is really a reflection of his own interests at the time.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, am I right in saying, it's not purely a literary interest, that Beckett's own interest in quietism maybe stems from factors in his own life at the time?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, he starts reading Schopenhauer, as I've said, for a particular book, but, you know, he really enjoys reading Schopenhauer. It becomes very a very personal author for him. The main reason I think Beckett becomes interested in quietism and these kind of themes is that during the 1930s, when he mostly uses the word, he was suffering from a lot of his own anxiety attacks. Mm-hmm. So since the age of 20, he'd wake up in the middle of the night, his body would be drenched in sweat, his mind would be racing, and his heart would be kind of thumping away. Mm-hmm. Quietism, because it's about calming the mind, might have a beneficial impact upon that. Mm-hmm. I think it's also interesting that whenever Schopenhauer talks about the will, so that's the very thing that's quietened and resigned and calmed in the quietistic philosophy, he uses the word heart as a metaphor for that. So, okay, you know, Beckett thinks here's a philosophy that can calm both heart and mind.
Okay. And obviously his interest is also, it is a literary one as well. It is a kind of aesthetic one. And is this something that we see, do we see Beckett incorporating his views on quietism into his work at this time?
Or? Yeah, definitely. He's thinking about quietism, as I've said, in relation to these writers. He also uses the word in relation to his friend's poetry. His friend Thomas McGreevy publishes a book of poems, and Beckett reviews it under the title Quietism, humanistic quietism, he calls mm-hmm. it. And I think in some of the early novels that he's writing in this period, you can see reflections of this. So there's two novels that Beckett writes in the 30s. Mm-hmm. Dream of Fair to Middling Women, which is his first novel.
It's a great title.
Fantastic title. And that's not actually published until after his death. It's a kind of a romana clef, which means it's got lots of characters from Beckett's own life, only very thinly disguised mm-hmm. and in particularly unflattering ways. Oh. So he, after having failed to publish it, he later saves it until he's dead.
But the other novel, presumably most of them.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. The other novel he's working on at this time is Murphy. Mm-hmm. From 1938 is when that's published. Mm-hmm. And both of the characters, Murphy and Balakwa, who's the main character of Dream, they are quietists of a certain kind. So Balakwa has a lot of the heart problems that Beckett has. He has a bitch of a heart that knocks the hell out of his bosom 3 or 4 nights in the week. And all he wants to do is lie lapped in a beatitude of indolence in a limbo purged of desire. So you can see how, you know, Balakwa's got the same kind of interests and priorities that Beckett does.
Mm-hmm. And they might be looking for the same kind of, they're looking for that same kind of relief.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
That overactive heart that we see in the earlier stuff as well. Now, evidently, in this period in the 1930s, this is a very interesting period for Beckett. As you say, he's living in London. Am I right in saying he's undergoing psychotherapy?
He has a good friend of his, Geoffrey Thompson, is a heart specialist. And he goes to Thompson and says, listen, I've got this problem. And Thompson says, I can find nothing wrong with your heart. And incidentally, this is also happens to Murphy as well. Mm-hmm. The doctors can't find anything wrong with his heart. Thompson says, well, you should go and do psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. And this is actually illegal in Ireland in the 1930s. Wow. So they send him off to the more enlightened country across the sea.
Excuse me, sorry.
Beckett starts some psychotherapy with a man called Wilfred Bion mm-hmm. In the Tavistock Clinic in London. This is something that he thinks is going to help him soothe his anxieties. I think in the end, he maybe draws some benefit from it, but I'm not sure he's completely convinced of its efficacy.
So would you like to give us a sense of how quietism feeds into Beckett's literary practice and Beckett's kind of ideas on form and on the novel itself?
Sure. So Beckett's a great admirer of James Joyce, the titan of Irish literature. Mm-hmm. During the 1930s, Joyce is working on his final novel, Finnegan's Wake. He's got this huge kind of coterie of disciples around him in Paris, where he's living in exile, really, mm-hmm. self-imposed exile. Beckett's a great admirer of Joyce. He's really enthralled to what he calls the omnipotent achievement of Ulysses, mm-hmm. which is the novel that Joyce has written just before Finnegan's Wake. He calls it a heroic achievement. He calls Joyce the superb manipulator of his material. And I think that Beckett eventually realises, after writing these early novels, like Dream, A Fair to Middling Women, and to a lesser extent Murphy, that he needs to do something different. He mm-hmm. he doesn't have the same faith in language that Joyce has. So he says that Joyce really believes in words. Beckett doesn't believe in words. Words are imperfect tools for him. They're unreliable, and he needs to work with something else. And so quietism, with its emphasis, I think, on impotence, on not knowing, on silence, these all feed into what is emerging as Beckett's unheroic aesthetic, mm-hmm. his desire to work with ignorance. Also, this an idea of incoherence as well. So I mentioned André Gide, the French novelist. Gide has a little book about Dostoevsky that Beckett uses when he's lecturing on Gide at Trinity College in Dublin in 1930. In that book, Gide describes Dostoevsky as a quietist writer. And the part of the reason that Dostoevsky is a quietist, according to Gide, is that he is interested in incoherence, renunciation and humility. Mm-hmm. And these are all things that Beckett takes into his later writing. This idea of characters not quite fitting together, of the text itself sort of falling away. Mm-hmm. And especially when you get in the late prose where, you know, there aren't really any characters at all. Mm-hmm. This is what we begin to see, but it's beginning early on.
So it's this kind of rejection of heroism, but also this, kind of, this gradual loss of faith in language itself, which I think is really fascinating. So maybe if we move on a little later, so what happens after this formative period, after Murphy's published? What comes next in Beckett's writing?
Beckett hasn't really achieved the literary success that he wanted to with Murphy. Mm-hmm. He had very lots of difficulty getting it published. It's not really selling that well. It's a very difficult novel. It's a young man trying to show how intelligent he is. It's a very, very funny novel, but it's not an easy read. Mm-hmm. And then the Second World War happens, and Beckett decides, I'm going to go to France. I'm going to stay in France, which is my now his adopted home. Mm-hmm. And his partner is French. And so he decides to stay with her in France and ride out the Second World War, mm-hmm. and eventually becomes a fighter for the resistance there. Although actually not fighting physically, he's transmitting messages. And then after the war, he's living in France still, and he decides that another way to get to this kind of ignorance or lack of power with language is to stop writing in English. So there's one of his notebooks where you see he's writing along in English, and then he just draws a line, starts writing in French. And this is the second part of his career, the next step. It's not necessarily as big a break with the earlier work as might be thought, and some of these quietest themes and aesthetics actually become perhaps more important at this stage.
Mm-hmm. And would you link that choice to move from English to French with that gradual loss of faith in language?
If he's writing in English, he's got all of the, you know, he studied English literature. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got the cadences of English in his mind. Mm-hmm. And although he was a very consummate linguist, he was absolutely fluent in French and he knew a lot about French culture and literature, there was still that little gap of alienation, of defamiliarity that would help him mm-hmm. to kind of lose control a bit more, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit more about the work then that comes out around this period. What's he working on?
Okay, so in my research, something that's been really important is the first novel of Beckett's post-war trilogy. So he writes three books in quite a quick succession in what he calls a frenzy of writing. And these are Molloy, Malone Dies, and The Unnameable. Mm-hmm. They're all published in French first, and Beckett then translates them into English himself, sometimes with collaboration. Now, most of the work that's been done on quietism has really looked at the 1930s and hasn't looked at a novel like Molloy, despite the fact that towards the end of the book, one of the characters recites a pretty quietist pater, which is a version of the Lord's Prayer, which I have with me here. So in the second half of Molloy, mm-hmm. there's a character introduced called Jacques Morin, mm-hmm. and he is an agent who's tasked with looking for Molloy. Mm-hmm. He introduces himself to the reader as a very good Catholic, a man of meticulous piety, he says. He's always sitting on the front row of church at Mass. Mm-hmm. So he's definitely not a quietist, not any kind of heretic. But after a journey of great inward metamorphoses, he returns home and finds himself reciting this very unorthodox prayer. Mm-hmm. Our Father, who art no more in heaven than on earth or in hell, I neither want nor desire that thy name be hallowed. Thou knowest what best suits thee, etc. The middle and the end are very pretty. Now, most critics have assumed that this is Beckett's own invention. Beckett was very interested in the Lord's Prayer, he was interested in the Bible, he burlesques them, pastiches them over and over again. But through my own research, I found actually that Beckett lifts this prayer from a 17th century text, a satirical text, about quietism.
Oh, wow.
This text is called Dialogues on Quietism. It's by a French essayist called Jean de la Bruyère. And the rest of it, I thought I'd read to you because it's, it continues to be quite good. So we have, yes, thou knowest what best suits thee. If thou wilt, it shall be, unless I want or desire it. That thy kingdom come or not come, it's all the same to me. I don't ask thee that thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It will be, no matter what I do. I can only resign myself to it. Give us this day our daily bread, which is thy grace, or give it not to us. I neither wish to have it, nor to be without it. Likewise, if thou forgivest my trespasses as I forgive those who trespass against me, that's all well and good. But if thou wouldst rather punish me by damnation, then so much the better, since it's thy pleasure. Finally, Father, I am too abandoned to thy will to ask thee to deliver me from temptation and from evil. So you can see why Beckett might have found this interesting and amusing.
Yeah.
But it also means that actually he's still interested in quietism at this time. And not just that, he's actually gone back to the original period of Christian quietism, the 17th century, and not just relying on someone like Schopenhauer. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about these dialogues is that there's a discussion between a quietist spiritual director and his penitent, his female penitent. And the director takes himself into all these very heretical quietist positions whilst the penitent sort of asks him questions. She's not really sure if he's really making sense. And then every time there's a contentious idea in the text itself, La Bruyère, the author, will footnote it with a reference to people like Madame Guyon and Miguel de Molinos, all these original quietists. So Beckett has direct access to this through this French text.
Mm, so it's a real sustained interest. So he's not just reaching it through Schopenhauer.
I mean, I think it's interesting that he reaches it through a satirical text, which means that, you know, no matter what his sympathies are, mm-hmm. he still can't resist sort of taking the piss a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it has to be a kind of joke. You know, that's his. It's like the letter about the horse. You know, it's a kind mm-hmm. of a slight defense mechanism, perhaps, to distance himself whilst also cleaving close to it.
It's finding the gag and finding this. And is that so? That's evidently not just an isolated moment in Molloy. Do you think that is there a quietest reading of Molloy?
Yeah. So that's what I've been trying to do. I've looked at the dialogues on quietism, which only exist in French at the moment, and I've just been going through them and finding the themes in there, and actually a lot of it corresponds to Molloy really well. Mm-hmm. So there's a nice little example of where, Molloy is a kind of resigned figure. He hasn't got a lot of enthusiasm for life like most Beckett characters, but there's some particular things that make me think that Beckett's really not just picking out at his own misery, but also his own interest in quietism. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit where Molloy sort of stops in the middle of his narrative and starts reflecting on where he is in the present moment of writing, really. And he says, "The confines of my room, of my bed, of my body, are as remote from me as were those of my region in the days of my splendour. And the cycle continues joltingly from flight and bivouac in an Egypt without bounds, without infant, without mother. And when I see my hands on the sheet, which they love to flossulate already, they are not mine, less than ever mine." Now, it's a tricky passage, but what Beckett's alluding to here with this idea of Egypt and the infant and the mother is, of course, the story of the flight to Egypt in the Gospels, mm-hmm. which is when Joseph and Mary run away from Herod with the baby Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's a very popular subject for painters, and Beckett was a great admirer of several of them, including Rembrandt's version of the rest and the flight to Egypt, which he would have seen in the National Gallery in Dublin when he was young, and also Adam Alsheimer, who's a Dutch painter, and he does another version of it. Beckett saw that whilst he was travelling in Germany. And what's interesting about both these paintings is that they're very, very dark. So there's a night sky, sometimes a moon and stars, but really not very much light, and just the light of the camp in the middle of the picture. And if you were to, as Molloy suggests, remove the bivouac, the tent, mm-hmm. remove the mother, remove the infant, you've just got basically darkness. Mm-hmm. You remove the bounds of the painting, and it's like you're being swallowed by darkness. You're being annihilated into darkness, which is precisely what the quietists were interested in. And more than that, the removal of those traditional bits of Christianity also suggests something quietist. So in the dialogues that Beckett draws on, the penitent is encouraged by her director not to think about Jesus, to pray to any of the saints, to read the Bible, mm-hmm. just to sit there and do nothing in her passive, quietest prayer. So by eliminating these things, Beckett's not only sort of suggesting that the paintings, I think, but also this kind of doctrinal erasure mm-hmm. within quietism.
And this annihilation seems to tie together so much. I mean, from Molloy back to Murphy and then back to Schopenhauer.
That's right. Heritage. It's completely consistent with Schopenhauer, and there's bits where he's still drawing on Schopenhauer, I think. As I mentioned, he's a real lifelong companion.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this interesting quietism is something that's seen in the later work beyond Molloy?
Yeah, so I've been looking at another novel of his, probably his last novel, really, what you can recognise him to be called a novel, called How It Is from the 1960s. And I think in this novel, actually, Beckett's looking at another religion that Schopenhauer's really interested in, which is Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Schopenhauer's an avid Buddhist of sorts, at least as far as you can be in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. He had a Buddha statue in his apartment, and he positioned it opposite the window so that the pastor on the other side of the street could look through his window, past his crucifix, and see Schopenhauer's Buddha on the other side of the street. Anyway. Beckett's been compared to Buddhism quite a lot, quite casually, and I was actually interested in picking apart one little reference in how it is, to a sage under the bow. So that's definitely the Buddha somewhere. But yeah, that's kind of another can of worms for another time, I think.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, I look forward to reading about it. I guess then one of the broader questions to ask is what this quietest reading of Beckett's prose, what does this do for our understanding of Beckett, and how does this fit into kind of wider debates in Beckett scholarship?
I guess since Beckett, you know, was writing, even during his life, people were very keen to connect him to a kind of mysticism. And it's undeniable that he has an interest in this. He definitely is interested in mysticism, but he's not a religious guy. He says he has no faculty whatsoever for the supernatural. Now, that might be sort of special pleading on his part, but I actually think that through quietism, we can actually understand Beckett's relationship to some of these mystical writers better. Mm-hmm. So it's not that he's interested in actually finding some sort of absolute truth or universal reality, divinity, or anything like that. He's more interested in kind of like the disposition, the sort of mood music of mysticism, which mm-hmm. you could say is quietism. The way Schopenhauer talks about quietism is as an attitude, the attitude of resignation, the attitude of melancholia, the attitude of giving up, the attitude of silence. And this is more what Beckett's interested in. And I think that within Beckett's studies, that helps clear up some debates. I mean, other people have been doing this as well, because we have this huge access to Beckett's archives now. At Reading and in Dublin and in Texas, there's lots and lots of Beckett's notebooks, his German diaries from the 1930s that are going to be published soon. Mm-hmm. Lots of really exciting stuff. This can help us clear up, I think, some of the more speculative approaches to Beckett that had existed in the past. Mm-hmm. And I see my work on quietism as part of that.
Okay. And with this opening up of Beckett's archives, I suppose I have to ask, what comes next with your own research? Where do you see your work going?
Well, very excitingly, the University of Reading has just acquired the 5 or so notebooks that Beckett used in writing Murphy.
Oh,
that's his first published novel. They're going to be made available for scholars soon, and I'm hoping just to go in and, you know, if there's anything in there that helps my own reading of the novel and some of the, perhaps, you know, there's notes on Schopenhauer that maybe get erased, or little hints of quietism or Buddhism or whatever in there, that will be the next thing to find out, really.
It'd be really fascinating to see. And just to finish up, and essentially to expand out to a much, much wider question, because it seems to me that at the heart of this research there are some questions about the interaction between religion and literature mm-hmm. in the 20th century. And is that something that you feel your research kind of plugs into that much broader question?
Yeah, it's a tiny plug into that big broader question, but it's a question that really interests me, because I think you look at the literature of the 20th century, and even at the margins perhaps, sometimes, perhaps mm-hmm. with other authors in the centre, the question of some sort of religious discontent is really going on. It's really motoring through. I mean, you might get it quite obviously in writers like Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene, who are very Catholic, openly struggling with their faith. Or you might get it at the edges of someone like Virginia Woolf, who has about as secular an upbringing as you can get, and yet she's still interested in moments of being, in a kind of religion of perception or something. And I think what my project, if it's doing anything, would perhaps suggest, as with Beckett, that there could be a kind of mood music or a sort of disposition, a kind of key, a musical key to some of this attitude that doesn't quite really depend upon believing or not believing or theology or metaphysics, but more about mood and about attitude and disposition, I think.
That's fantastic. Well, Andy, I want to thank you for just some thrilling new insights into someone as fascinating as Beckett. So thank you so much
for coming. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this Cambridge PhD cast, presented by me, John Gallagher, and produced by Richard Blakemore and Ruth Rushworth, produced in association with Crash. If you'd like to hear more from us and for our fantastic collection of PhD casters, please visit the Crash website at crash, that's with 2 S's, .cam.ac.uk. Thank you for listening.